Yeah, well, thanks so much for organizing this, and I have to say that, I mean, since I work on more typically on formal epistemology and decision theory, so for me it's a great conference, I think, or a great opportunity to bring together formal and traditional epistemologists and applied. So I'm looking very much forward to the conference. So the topic of this talk is really, you know, how we should understand the degree of belief numbers that we see in, for instance, formal models of belief and agency, in particular in Bayes' epistemology, but also in social sciences and you know, in particular economics. So, I mean, in all normative or typical normative models, like Bayesian models, these degrees of belief are probabilities. But even in non-normative models in social sciences, you have theories like prospect theory, where it's assumed that we can represent the agent's beliefs or their degrees of beliefs by precise numbers, or not whereby precise, I don't necessarily mean a single, but even if it's a range of number, at least it's some sort of numerical representation of them that's possible. So the question is, how should we understand these numbers? I mean, so this is really kind of, I guess, a metaphysical question. What is the thing that is being represented? Well, the traditional answers, in particular in philosophy of economics and decision theory, are, on the one hand, what I call pragmatism, which is the view that degree of belief can be reduced to preference. And the idea is that, at least in ideal circumstances, these preferences are revealed in choice. So therefore, this view is often thought of as some sort of behaviorism. Actually, I'm going to sit on the other side so we can see the computer screen. I want to see. So the other view, the other traditional view, is called mentalism, which is the idea that the degree of belief is psychologically real and primitive. And the idea is that what these numbers represent is something that explains the choices and the preferences that these choices reveal. In a paper called What is Real in Probabilism, which is coming out in Australasian Journal this year, probably it's already online, I argue for a third view, which I call comparativism, which is the view that comparative belief is primitive and real and explains choices and the underlying preferences. So just to give you examples of what comparativism says, so the idea is that it might be a fact about some person, called Anna, that she believes more strongly that it will rain than that it will snow, for instance. So this is a sort of realism about comparative belief. But I claim there's no fact of the matter about the precise degree with which Anna believes either proposition. So this is some sort of anti-realism about degree of belief. Okay. And I argue that all claims about degrees of belief are true only, or can be true only relative to an arbitrarily chosen numerical model of that belief, are arbitrary from an epistemic point, not maybe from a practical point. So this is some sort of relativism about degree of belief statements, right? So similar to relativism in ethics, where you might say, where people might think that, you know, degrees of claims about morality hold or true only relative to some system of norms, for instance. I claim that degree of belief statements, or statements about degrees of belief, are true only relative to some chosen numerical number model. But epistemically, there's no reason. There are a number of models that one could choose, and there's no epistemic reason for choosing one rather than the other. So here's a challenge for comparativism that I'm going to talk about and address in this talk. Can we make sense of statements like, I am twice as confident in A as in B in terms of the comparative relation only? And by the way, in this talk, I shall be using confidence and degree of belief interchangeably. Right? So when I say my confidence in and my degree of belief in, by that I mean the same thing. So the question is, can we make sense of these kind of claims in terms of the comparative relation only? Or is it maybe the case that all such claims can only be true relative to some numerical model? And if that's the case, if the latter is the case, then I would have to accept that there are no what I call ratio facts. Right? There are no facts about, for instance, it can't be a fact about me that I believe one proposition twice as strongly as I believe another. It might be true only relative to some arbitrarily chosen numerical model. So that's the challenge, so that's the problem. I'm going to argue that actually we can make sense of statements like these. So there are ratio facts about belief. But I'm going to show that a particular route to comparativism can't allow for that. Right? So I'm going to argue, maybe unsurprisingly, that the type of comparativism that I've defended can make sense of these type of claims, but an older argument for comparativism cannot. Okay, so here's a roadmap or overview of the talk. So I'm going to start with a few remarks about motivation for comparativism in general. And then I'm going to discuss briefly an argument, a very nice argument by Lyle Sinda for comparativism, or for what he calls weak realism about degrees of belief, which is the same thing as what I'm calling comparativism, which is a pragmatic argument, or maybe I should say it's part of a general pragmatic view of his. And I'll explain why pragmatist comparativists can't and might not want to meet the challenge that I'm discussing. Then I'll just very briefly go through my arguments in this paper, what was in probabilism, and I'll sketch the formal model I used to show why someone who accepts that type of comparativist view can meet this challenge of making sense of ratio facts or ratio statements in terms of the comparative relation only. Okay, so that's the overview. So just some general motivation behind this comparativist view. So, I mean, a comparativist would typically say, I guess, maybe I shouldn't use typically because it's not a view that has been discussed a lot, but at least me and Lyle Sinda, they think this, the following. So there's no reason to accept realism about any particular type of numerical degree of belief, since first of all, comparative belief can play all the role we might want numerical degree of belief to play. And secondly, no possible evidence could justify attributing one type of numerical degree of belief rather than another to an agent. So as I'll show you in a moment, even if you accept that we can represent an agent's degrees of belief with numbers, there's a whole lot of different models that we might use that are equally good from the perspective of representing the agent's degrees of belief. But nevertheless, they're not consistent with each other. There are important differences. So therefore, a comparativist might say we should be at most realist about the comparative belief relation that each acceptable numerical system entails, right? So if we take this class of numerical models that are all equally good at representing the agent's degrees of belief, what they have in common is a comparative belief relation that each of them is meant to represent, and in fact which each of them implies, but the converse doesn't hold because you need some additional assumption to get the numerical representation. Okay, so that's kind of a general motivation for comparativism. So here's a particular version of this argument given by Lyle Sinda in a paper called doesn't matter, from 2000 in Philosophy of Science. And actually, this statement is not from Lyle Sinda, but from Patrick Maher, who states this view very forcefully and clearly. But Lyle Sinda actually quotes this statement of pragmatism favorably. So, and this is just how I can think of how I characterize. In my view, an almost perfect description of this pragmatist view. So pragmatists understand attributions of probability and utility, in other words, attributions of degrees of belief and degrees of desire, as essentially a device for interpreting a person's preferences. So in this view, an attribution of probabilities and utilities is correct just in case it's part of an overall interpretation of the person's preferences that makes sufficiently good sense of them and better sense than any competing interpretation does. Right? So the only criteria of correctness for attributing a degree of belief to a person is whether that particular degree of belief provides or is part of a good interpretation of the person's preferences. So correctness in this sense is exhausted by how well it interprets the preference. And actually, if you look at the kind of the decision theories that these pragmatists, the typical pragmatists, use, it turns out that what they believe is actually, over the view they hold is quite a bit stronger than this, because they actually, it follows from the theory, it seems to follow at least, that what it means to believe one proposition more strongly than another is to prefer a bet on the one rather than the other. So for instance, what it means to believe more strongly that a coin will come up heads than tails, let's say, just is to prefer a bet whereby you get £10 if the coin comes up heads, rather than a bet where the coin comes up tails, where you get £10 if the coin comes up tails, right? So if you look at, for instance, the decision theories of Ramsey and Savage and Patrick Meyer, comparative belief is actually defined in this way, roughly. Of course, we should add under certain ideal circumstances and so on. Now, okay, so on this, so that was just pragmatism in general. It doesn't follow that you should be comparativist. However, if you hold this pragmatist view, then it cannot be more correct to attribute to a person subjective probabilities than to attribute to them what Lyle Sidnott calls believabilities. And so a believability is in many ways similar and in some ways dissimilar from a probability. So to figure out the believability of an event, if you know the probability of it, the subjective probability according to some individual, you multiply the probability by 9 and add to it 1. Right? So what this means is that a believability function ranges from 1 to 10, and it's a subadditive. We'll see an example of what that means in a moment, that it's subadditive. Now, so why is it the case that a pragmatist can't say that it's more correct to attribute degrees of probabilities rather than believabilities to a person? Well, the reason is that if a person's preferences can be represented as maximizing expected utility relative to some probability function, then these preferences can also be represented as maximizing what's called valuation relative to the believability function. And by the way, it's assumed that if you can represent someone's preferences as maximizing expected utility, let's say, and if you have done so, then that particular representation provides a perfect interpretation of the person's preferences. In other words, the utilities and the probabilities that you use to represent the preferences, if it turns out that particular utility function and probability function that you chose can represent the agent's preferences as maximizing expected utility, then these pragmatists say that you have perfectly interpreted the person's preferences. You might question that, but I'm not going to go into that particular worry. Now, so here's just a quick illustration of why this holds. So this is just the traditional expected utility formula. Alpha of SI is just the outcome of alternative alpha in state of the world SI. So to figure out the expected utility of alpha, where alpha is just some alternative or let's say an action you might perform, you figure out the utility of alpha in each state of the world, and you multiply that by the probability of that state of the world, and then you just add up. Now, to figure out the valuation of alpha, you do something that's quite similar. You first take the utility of alpha in state of the world SI, multiply that by the believability of that state of the world, but then you subtract the utility of alpha in that state of the world. And intuitively, you have to do that because otherwise, remember that believabilities range from 1 to 10. So if you don't do that, then what happens is that the outcomes in state of the world that you're sure won't be realized are going to have an effect on the overall utility or valuation of the alternative. Now, it's not too hard to see, at least if you stare at this for a minute, that these two measures are going to rank the alternatives in the same way. Right? So alpha has a higher expected utility than beta, if and only if alpha has a higher valuation than beta. In other words, these two measures agree on the ranking of alternatives, which means that if it turns out that the way in which alternatives are ranked by energy's preferences can be represented by this, then it can also be represented by this. Right? So, in other words, if the correctness of attributing to someone a numerical degree of belief is exhausted by how good that attribution, or how good the interpretation that that attribution is a part of, how good that interpretation is, then there's no way, then you have no grounds for saying that attributing subjective probabilities to the agent can be more correct than attributing to them these believabilities. And this last step is maybe not, it doesn't maybe follow logically from the previous, but at least Lal Shinder concludes that, well, then we pragmatists should accept as real, as psychologically real, whatever these two and all measures that also can figure in a good representation or perfect representation, which should accept as real whatever they have in common. And what they do have in common is a comparative belief relation that orders events or propositions in terms of how likely the agent considers them. Okay, and I should say maybe, by the way, that Cannaro, the great economist who passed away last week, he already made a point, which is essentially this point in his in his PhD thesis, which became later Social Choice and Individual Value. And so in social choice theory and I guess formal ethics, a result like this has been used to criticize Harshani's argument for utilitarianism, because there he shows that if we assume that the social planner has preferences with a particular structure, then it turns out that the social planner can be represented as an expected utility maximizer. But by this type of result, we also know that, well, the social planner can also be represented as something that's not an expected utility maximizer. So it's not really the case that Harshani has vindicated utilitarianism, but some sort of class of aggregation rule that have some properties in common. Similarly, here just focusing on the beliefs, even if an agent satisfies all the constraints that such that they can be represented as an expected utility maximizer, it doesn't follow that we shouldn't say that his or her degrees of belief are probabilities. What we should say is that they have a certain structure such that they can be represented as, for instance, probabilities, but also as believabilities and so on. So in conclusion, these pragmatists hold that we should accept as real just whatever all of these functions have in common. Okay, so now maybe it's obvious already, but I think it's worth going through this in a bit detail. So if the difference between a probability function and a believability function doesn't correspond to anything that's psychologically real, one has to conclude that there are no ratio facts about beliefs. These ratio features are just true relative to some arbitrary numerical model. Okay, so here is just an example that illustrates this. Suppose that you believe that some coin is fair. You believe that it's just a normal coin and so on. And so this, your subjective probability for heads is 0.5. And which is, of course, your half of your subjective probability for heads or tails, which is 1. However, your believability, or the believability number that represents your confidence in heads, is 5.5. Right? Remember I said that to figure out the believability of a proposition, the believability of a proposition or an event, you multiply its probability by 9 and add to it 1, and you get 5.5 in this case. But of course, that's not half of your believability for heads or tails, which is 10. Remember that. You can see that by the same transformation, times 9 plus 1. So this is also an example that illustrates why believabilities are not what's called additive; they're subadditive. If you add heads and tails, you get something that's the believability for heads or tails is less than the believability of heads plus the believability of tails, even though heads and tails are, by assumption, mutually incompatible. So believabilities are not additive like probabilities. You see that this probability is additive, assuming that the probability for heads is, therefore tails is 0.5 as well. Now, so, and more generally, of course, this is just what I'm said. What I've said here is just about probabilities and believabilities. But the same is true of all of these other possible measures that we could use if we want to, or if the only goal is to represent data's preferences. Right? So if attribution of degrees of belief to a person is correct, just in case it's part of some benefit-maximizing representation of the preferences, then there are no race effects. We have to just accept that these are just arbitrary features, or features of arbitrarily chosen models. In contrast, I think that there are such facts, right? I think that, I mean, intuitively, I think we would say that it might be a fact about me that I'm twice as confident in a tautology as in heads. And moreover, I think this intuition gains support by the observation that there are limits to how strongly we can believe something, and how strongly we cannot believe something. So it's meaningful to talk about full belief and full disbelief. And moreover, even on a pragmatist understanding, we might think that that's meaningful. I mean, we could ask, you know, would you bet anything on this event, on its truth or its falsity? So it seems that even a pragmatist should say that there's an upper and lower bound on how strongly you can believe something. But of course, it's a general fact about measurement that if you can represent a relation by cardinally, as even the pragmatists accept, and moreover there is an upper and lower bound on the measure, then what you have is then that relation can be represented or measured by a ratio scale. In other words, then there are these ratio facts that are not just relative to any particular and to any particular model, and not true on any other, on some other equally good model. Right. So, I mean, I want to say that intuitively there are ratio facts, and I'm gonna in a moment show you why that idea is consistent with the version of comparatism that I've endorsed. And also, I think, we can discuss this if you want to, but I think that there are more general and independent arguments against this type of pragmatism. At least the strong version where you say that we can define belief in terms of preference. Because I think that although pragmatists are correct in saying that often, maybe typically, preferences are the best way to measure beliefs, I think we have good reasons to think that beliefs can't be reduced to preferences. So maybe the best example of why this is the case, or why I think this is the case, is an example discussed by Hayek and Erickson in a paper called "What Are Degrees of Belief?" So they ask you to mention this Zen monk, who is perfectly content with his situation, and of course this is a fictional character, but I mean it seems at least metaphysically possible. And he sits in front of the mountains and is viewing them. And epistemically, he's much like a normal agent. He believes that one mountain is closer than the other, and so on. But because he's happy with whatever happens, he's indifferent between all bets concerning, you know, how close the different mountains are to him. But that doesn't mean that he believes equally strongly in the proposition mountain A is equally close to me as mountain B is equally close to me. And moreover, even if we know that he's indifferent between all these bets, we might still be interested in asking, but what is your probability for this? How strongly do you believe that this mountain is closer than that, right? So it doesn't seem to be the case that that our interest in attributing to people degrees of belief is exhausted by our interest in representing their preferences. We can think also of instrumentally irrational agents, right? We might know what a person prefers, but we might think, well, I think they're being instrumentally irrational, so I want to inquire about their beliefs, even though I know what they prefer. So, so this is why I think this is why I think that even though I think we should be comparativists, we shouldn't be pragmatist comparativists. Okay, so just some brief arguments for what I call primitivist comparativism, which is the idea that not only is this comparative relation psychologically real, it's also primitive in the sense that it can't be defined in terms of or reduced to any other attitude. Okay, so and this is, by the way, from that paper. Well, most of this is from that paper that I cited earlier, and I'm not going to go through all of this. But in general, I think that there are maybe many more, but at least four desiderata that we would want a concept of non-categorical belief to satisfy. So we would want it to allow for normal, you can folk psychological explanations of people's choices, right? So we want to explain people's choices or the preferences that they reveal in terms of their underlying desires, that is, non-instrumental desires and their beliefs. Moreover, such a concept of belief should allow for there to be interpersonal facts about belief. It should allow it for it to make sense to say that Anne is more confident than Bob that things will go well, or that it will rain, and so on. It should also allow for what's called cardinal facts about belief. It should make the following kind of statements meaningful and not in a relative sense. So, for instance, the difference between my confidence in 2 plus 2 is 4 and in 2 plus 2 is 3, in other words, the difference between my confidence in a tautology and a contradiction, is greater than the difference between my confidence in it's raining now in Stockholm versus it's snowing now in Stockholm. So I think I'm probably slightly more confident that it's snowing now in Stockholm than it's raining now in Stockholm. But I'm much, much more confident in a tautology than in a contradiction. Right? And we want this to be, this type of claim to be meaningful. In other words, we want there to be cardinal facts about belief. Meaningful in a non-relative sense. And possibly hold true in a non-relative sense. And finally, and that's what I'm going to focus on now for the remainder of this talk, we want there to be ratio facts about belief. We want statements like, I'm twice as confident in the coin coming up heads once, as in it's coming up heads twice in two tosses. We want these statements to be meaningful, possibly true, possibly false, in a non-relative sense. We want there to be ratio facts about belief. Now, I claim, and I think I can show, that comparative belief is necessary and sufficient for these four desiderata. Now, you might think that, I mean, it's evident that, just focusing on 2 to 4, it's evident that realism about comparative belief is necessary for, let's say, for there to be facts like this. I mean, it would have to be a fact about me that I'm more confident in H as in HH for there to be a fact such as me being twice as confident in HS and HH. But some people, in particular Christopher Meacham and Jonathan Weisberg, have claimed that realism about comparative belief is not sufficient for there to be such facts of these three kinds. And they raise that as a criticism against Lyle Sinder. So in the paper that I already mentioned, What's Real in Probabilism, I show that actually that's not true for these type of facts, which is actually the type of facts that Meacham and Weisberg discussed. And we can discuss that also if you want. But what I'm going to focus on here, which is an objection that has been raised to me against me since, is that I didn't show that realism about comparative belief is sufficient for these type of facts. Okay, and that's what I'm going to do now. Okay, so to show that, I have to just quickly run through the constraints that I assume on a rational comparative belief relation, and later I'll just mention what this means for non-rational or ordinary comparative belief. So I assume that a rational comparative belief relation, or a rational comparative belief, is what's called a qualitative probability. So here is just some notation. So this here is a relation of comparative belief, so that you should read this formula here, or this claim here, as the agent, some agent of interest, being at least as confident in B as in A. Okay. And omega is just a Boolean algebra generated from the set of states of the world. So it's a set of subsets of the set of states of the world, closed under the Boolean operators, Boolean logical operators. I'll just interpret omega as the agent's, let's say, opinion set, and we can interpret the elements there as, let's say, events or propositions. So here's the definition of a qualitative probability. So a relation like this is a qualitative probability, just in case, for any three events in omega. First of all, the relation weakly orders the events, which means that the relation is transitive, right? If F is at least as if the agent is at least as confident in F as in E, and at least as confident in G as in F, then they're at least as confident in G as in E. And secondly, it has to be complete. So either the agent is at least as confident in F as in E, or at least as confident in E as in F. Now, we can relax completeness, in which case we get sets of orderings that have the right structure. And that's actually fine as long as we are willing to say that there are sets of cardinal facts, for instance, but I won't go into that complication. Secondly, the relation for it to be a qualitative probability, it has to satisfy what I call qualitative additivity. So what this means is that, so suppose that G and E have no element in common, they're mutually incompatible, and also G and F have no element in common, then the agent is at least as confident in F as in G, if and only if she's at least as confident in the union of F with G as in the union of E with G. Right. So so intuitively, since G has no element in common with either E or F, it just cancels out here. And so it's ranked according to how E and F are ranked. Finally, it's just a normality condition, a rather trivial condition, which says that the agent is at least as confident in any event as in the tautology, in the contradiction of the empty event. And they're strictly more confident in any tautology or the full state space as in the contradiction or the empty event. Okay. So that's a qualitative probability. Now, I also have to assume that the relation is continuous to get the type of results that I want. Now, here is one continuity condition that does a trick, originally from Leonard Savage. So this condition says that if the agent is strictly more confident in F as in E, strictly more confident than being defined from weakly more confident in the standard way, then there is a partition of the state space. In other words, we can slice up the set of states into pairwise incompatible and mutually exhaustive cells, such that the agent is still more confident in F than in the union of E with each of these, each cell from the partition. So, in other words, what this really means is that we can partition the state space arbitrarily finely, slice it up as finely as we want. And Savage himself justified this assumption by pointing out that, I mean, if you take any partition, you can partition it more finely by imagining how some coin would come up had it been tossed. Right, so we can go on and on and on partition things more and more finely. Now, and here is finally a theorem a collection of results from what is real in probabilism and the paper on which this talk is based. And so the result is that if a comparative relation is a qualitative probability and also continuous, then it directly entails interpersonal, cardinal, and ratio properties. Of course, this of course only holds if you have two such relations for two individuals. Okay. Focusing on cardinal and ratio properties, what this means is that, so even if we accept that numerical degrees of belief are just useful fictions, we can still say that these features of the belief of the agent epistemic state are real. They correspond to real psychological states because they are directly entailed by the comparative relation. Right? So even if we accept that just anything that's directly entailed by the comparative relation is real, it follows that these features are real. Now, of course, the numerical representation is not directly entailed. No numerical representation is directly entailed by the comparative relation. We also need to assume that it's some additional things like, well, m- most obviously that it's represented within a certain range, 0 to 1, for instance. So I won't go through the argument or the proof in any detail, but I'm just gonna give you 2 minutes, I hope. I'm just gonna give you a very quick illustration of why this holds. So if the comparative relation is a continuous qualitative probability, then we can define twice as confident as follows, and we can tweak it slightly to make it 3 times as confident, so on. Okay, so we can say that an agent with a comparative belief relation with a format and structure is twice as confident in A as in B, just in case there is some other event in the agent's opinion state, such that the agent is indifferent between B and that event, the event that I'm calling B star, and moreover, they have no element in common, B and B star, and finally, the agent is equally confident in A as in the union of B with B star. It seems like a natural definition of twice as confident, and it turns out that if, as long as the relation satisfies these properties, then the agent satisfies these three conditions in the type of situations where we would intuitively want to say that they are twice as confident in A as in B, right? And we can show this. I won't go into that. Okay, so just finally, to just before I wrap up. So as you saw here, this is, we treat this as a definition. It's defined for agents with this type of comparative belief relation. But we know that most of us, actually our comparative belief is not a qualitative probability. So you might have heard about, for instance, Linda the bank teller, this example, who turns out that if you give people the right sort of background information, they will tell you that they are more confident that Linda is a feminist bank teller than that she is a bank teller. And of course, the correct background information are the type of things that people usually associate with being a feminist. Now, of course, it can't be more probable, if you choose a person randomly, it can't be more probable that they are it doesn't matter how you choose them, it can't be more probable that they are a feminist bank teller than a bank teller, because if they are a feminist bank teller, then they are a bank teller. Now, people have questioned the significance of this result, but in any case, I mean, it seems plausible that for most of us, we actually don't satisfy all of these constraints, these constraints of having beliefs that are continuous qualitative probabilities. So what should we say of people like us? Well, I think that the right thing to say, and this is, I don't think this is a big bullet to bite, I think this is very plausible, I think that it's we should say that it's often indeterminate whether or not we're twice as confident in E, S, and F. For there are lots of events that we have opinions on where it's indeterminate whether we're twice as confident in one as in the other. And similarly for these cardinal and interpersonal effects. But importantly, it's not always indeterminate. So, I mean, it's not, so this is really a psychological hypothesis. It's not, well, first of all, I mean, this I think I can say with strong confidence that at least when it comes to things like claims like more than twice as confident, I think it's pretty determinate that each of us is more than twice as confident in some events than in others. But even for the precisely twice as confident, I mean, I think there are subsets of our opinion sets where that do satisfy all these constraints on the qualitative belief. For instance, if you think just of the subset containing propositions about lotteries that we know the probabilities of and so on. So just to conclude, I think that if we accept that rational comparative belief has the type of structure that I have given, then it's always determinate whether or not the agent is twice as confident in one event as another. But for normal agents, it's not always determinant, but at least it's sometimes determinant. The extent to which it's determinant is, of course, a psychological question, or empirical question. Okay, that's it. Thanks.